today on the 21st, Illinois has the highest property taxes in the country, according to a report out last week by CoreLogic. Here's my question for you listening. Do you think your property taxes are too high? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet us at 21st Show. Lots of news on the utility beat. An announcement yesterday that three coal power plants are slated to be shut down. And while we lead the nation in the amount of nuclear energy Illinois produces as a state, that could soon change. We'll fill you in. And 9 years after the chief was retired, the University of Illinois is forming a committee to create what the university says is its first ever mascot. What do students think?
I'd like to see Chief Lenny Wick brought back.
I think it's rude to take someone else's culture and put it on display and use it in that sense.
I like the idea that they are looking into a mascot to bring some unity to the campus.
What comes next in the search for that mascot? That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's a time of year when many people are getting property tax bills in the mail, and if you haven't yet, you should probably brace yourself. Illinois has the highest property taxes in the country. That's according to a recent CoreLogic analysis. So what goes into property taxes, and why are they so high here? Do you think your property taxes are too high? Do you worry about where the revenue goes? You can join our conversation. Our phone number, as always, is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can always tweet your questions or comments as well to 21st Show. Joining us today is Ted Dabrowski. He's Vice President of Policy for the Illinois Policy Institute. They're an independent research group that focuses in part on limited taxation. Ted, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the simple question, which may not have a simple answer, but why does Illinois have the highest property taxes?
Well, you know, I think some people can figure it out that we happen to have one of the most corrupt governments in the nation. And a big part of that is that we have the most units of government in the nation. So when you add up all the park districts, school districts, mosquito abatement districts, and townships, and when you add them all up, we have more than any other state.
Right. So there's almost 7,000 local government entities throughout the state. That's more than any other state by far, right?
That's right. And what that means is that all those units of government can raise taxes, can borrow. They all have their boards, so they all have pensions. And when you start adding it all up, it's really impossible for a taxpayer or any watchdog group to really try to keep track of what's going on. And that's where you get the corruption, you get too much debt, and you get salaries and pensions that are out of whack with what normal people can afford.
And apart from all of that, let's talk about where property taxes are meant to go. Because I think that people tend to think, oh, maybe mostly these go for schools. But what else does property tax revenue get used for throughout the state of
Illinois? Well, so, you know, 70% of most cities, 60 to 70% do go to the school district. So if you want to keep an eye on where your taxes are going, go to school board meetings and figure out what's going on there. But the other big, 30% goes to pay for good old government, right? Police, fire, just the normal operations of a city, paving the roads, et cetera. But a huge chunk of that goes to pensions. And it's the pensions that are just blowing up the finances because more and more money is going to pay for these guaranteed pensions that the taxpayers don't have, but they have to pay for when it comes to their government.
And Ted, when we're thinking about this, I wonder if it makes sense to have a conversation about property taxes. Do you need to compare that without taking that into account state and local sales taxes? You know, there's been conversation about the graduated income tax. Does it make sense to compare property taxes without taking into account the total amount the taxpayers have to bill every year?
You know, fortunately, there's groups that compare tax rates across different states so that you can kind of figure out what's going on. And, you know, you should look at property taxes in Illinois compared to other states just to see where we are. And what you'll see there is you'll find, based on most reports, you'll find us either at number one, number two, or number three highest in the nation. Now, in some states, they may have high property taxes, but they may pay other taxes that are low. In the case of Illinois, that's not the case. We tend to find that we're the highest property taxpayers, but then we're also paying really high taxes for many other things like cell phones and gasoline taxes. And when you add them all up, we're always in the top 10 of the highest taxes in the nation.
Here's a comment that we got on Facebook from Karen in Champaign. Karen says, I've lived in Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, and now Illinois. Our property here is not the most valuable property I've lived in. And the Champaign Public School District where we live is probably third in the top in terms of quality. And our property taxes here are significantly more in percentage terms than any other home in which we've lived. I don't mind paying taxes. I don't mind paying high taxes as long as there's a fair value exchange. But what am I getting in return? And I think that's Karen from Champaign who commented on our Facebook page. By the way, you can find us if you search for the 21st show on Facebook. Ted, I think a lot of people would probably make the comment that Karen did and wants to know, do you, and I guess this is my question for you. It sounds like you don't think that taxpayers are getting a good value here.
Well, you know, what I'd like to say is that, you know, people are willing to pay taxes if they get good services for them, and that's understandable. But what's happening across Illinois when you talk about the pension crisis, which is the elephant in the room when we talk about property taxes,
sure.
That's where most of our money's going these days. When you talk about property taxes, then you start to say, well, if I'm going to pay more, am I going to get more policemen on the street for it? Am I going to get more teachers in my school? Are my roads going to be better paved? And the answer is no. Most of these increases, and you're seeing this hugely in Chicago, but in all across the state, is you're putting more and more money into property taxes, but you're not going to see any benefits for them. You're just going to see it going to old debt to pay for pensions.
That's a good point. Karen also added she wanted to know what her taxes were doing for people in need. This is what Karen wrote. All I hear about are cuts to social programs at institutions. Where is my money going? And I think that to tack on another question I was going to ask to that, Ted, do you also foresee, as we're talking about the pension situation and the desperate lack of revenue the state seems to be facing, do you have a sense that property taxes will continue to go up?
Well, so, you know, what we need to see are reforms. You mentioned the term desperate revenue needs. You know, we're looking at revenues have grown across the state. They've grown dramatically. If you look at property taxes, we analyze the numbers. Since 1990, property taxes have grown 3.3 times faster than people's incomes. So that means that a bigger and bigger chunk of people's paychecks are going straight to property taxes. The revenue growth has been there. The question is, what the heck are they spending it on? And that's where you get to either all this debt that school districts and cities and municipalities have piled up, or it's going to pay for higher and higher pensions, benefits that are out of control with what people can afford. So when you add all that stuff up, we need to look at how we reform the cost of government, how we reform pensions, and move to 401k-style plans is what we should do. It's what everybody in the private sector has.
Apart from pension reform, can I ask you one last question, Ted, about business climate and about how much the effect property taxes have among businesses, whether you think we've been talking about personal property taxes, but do you see an effect on businesses either relocating or leaving simply because of property taxes, apart from other taxes?
Absolutely. When you add up all the debt we have, unless we reform pensions, that means that taxes are going up, property taxes. And, you know, GE was thinking about moving its headquarters to Chicago, and they finally said, no, we're not moving to Chicago. There's too much debt. There's too much pension debt, and there's too much uncertainty. And, you know, if you're a family that's trying to make ends meet, you're going to look at your tax bill and say, is this the right place to live? Or if you're a new company looking to open up in Illinois, you're going to say, you know what, I'm going to invest elsewhere. It's just too expensive here.
As for individual property tax owners, do you suggest that they challenge that? Like that they appeal their property taxes? Just curious.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, you have to appeal just because the process is so messed up that if you don't appeal, then you end up paying more than you should. That's number one. But I think the bigger issue is, you know, how do we collectively demand a better spending from our government, and how do we demand reform so that our taxes don't keep going up? That's the bigger question. We need to demand government to be more effective and efficient.
That's Ted Dabrowski. He's Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute on Property Taxes. Ted, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. Now, turning to women's health, many women who survive a heart attack avoid sexual activity afterwards because they're afraid that they're going to trigger another one. And unlike their male counterparts, women's doctors rarely talk about this issue with their patients. With us today to talk about this is Dr. Lauren Stryker. She's an associate clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She's the author of Sex Rx, Hormones, Health, and Your Best Sex Ever. She's talking about this on Friday at a women's cardiovascular symposium at Prentice Women's Hospital, Northwestern Medicine in Chicago. She's here to tell us about it now. Dr. Stryker, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let me start by asking, is it standard for doctors to talk to men about sex after a heart attack? Is that a typical conversation that happens?
Well, we know that it's a lot more common. We also know that men are more likely to bring it up. You know, a guy who's sitting with his cardiologist is more likely to say, okay, doc, you know, am I good to go? And women very often don't have that conversation. And in fact, studies have shown that only about 35% of women get any kind of information about resuming sexual activity after their heart attack. But then we also have to talk about what is that conversation even when it does happen. There's a very big difference between is it okay to have sex versus is it okay to, you know, have an orgasm or is it okay to do something more unusual. People just don't want to go there. So they don't, and they're just, the conversation is not happening.
Well, before we get to that conversation, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How many cardiologists are, do we know what percentage of cardiologists are female to male?
I don't know. I do know that there are a lot more than there used to be, but in fairness, sometimes it's the guys that are more likely to talk about it than the women. I think we have this assumption that women doctors are better about talking about sexual health than the male counterparts, and that's not always the case.
Well, actually, what I was thinking, Dr. Stryker, is that female patients might be more likely to discuss this with a female doctor than a male
doctor. You are 100%
correct. That's how I was thinking about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I always say people don't want to talk about this with someone who looks like their father and even less so with someone who looks like their son, so they just don't bring it up at all.
And so let's have the conversation. What do we know about, is sex after a heart attack a reasonable fear for a woman?
It's actually not. We know that about 70% of women post-myocardial infarction avoid sexual activity, either because they're terrified or, quite frankly, the spouse is. You know, the spouse is saying, hey, I love you, honey, and it's not worth it to, you know, if you come, have you go. So they just don't go there. And the fear is really, for the most part, unfounded. And what people are surprised to hear that's depressing and reassuring at the same time is that having sex with your spouse in your bedroom requires the same amount of exertion as a 2 to 4 mile per hour stroll on a level surface for about 5 minutes.
Okay.
I mean, think about that.
All right.
You know,
well,
and studies have actually shown that the heart rate doesn't go up. But there was a very key thing that I said, and it's the having sex with your spouse, because studies have also shown that if you look at who is the most likely to have a heart attack when they're having sex, it's when you're doing something you shouldn't be doing. It's when you're with, you know, you're having the affair, you're with the, you know, the woman that that maybe you're the man that you shouldn't be with.
Oh, okay. That's a whole other level of a conversation, right?
Exactly.
Well, which is also probably what would make, so what questions should women who have had heart attacks, if you're nervous about bringing it up with your, what should you say?
Well, basically what you should say is, you know, I'm glad that I'm doing well and I'm, you know, looking forward to moving on. And is it risky for me to engage in sexual activity? Is it risky for me to have an orgasm? Do you have any suggestions for me? Is my vibrator going to get in the way of my pacemaker? You know, be specific. I promise you, you will not shock your doctor. You know, but these are the questions I talk about in SexRx because these are questions that, quite frankly, people would rather read a book than go to their doctor and say, is my vibrator going to get in the way of my pacemaker? But there's really another piece of this, too, that doesn't get discussed. You know, we've talked about, is it safe to have sex? But once you get past that, and once you do get the go-ahead from your cardiology and you're having intercourse or having sexual activity and everything's fine, then the other piece of that is, how are things going to go? You know, are you going to have problems? Just like men who have coronary artery disease very often have erectile dysfunction, women also have physical repercussions as a result of their vascular disease. So they may have dryness. They may have inability to have an orgasm. And these are not things that their cardiologist is necessarily going to talk about. So there's really two pieces to this.
Do doctors get trained on this?
And how's it going to go?
Yeah. Do doctors, is this part of cardiovascular? I mean, and I guess this is probably a broader conversation about doctor-patient relations and what training happens in medical school versus real life. But is this something in thinking about, especially as I'm thinking about the context of what we know about women and cardiovascular disease and how often that also gets overlooked in many conversations with doctors, What are doctors being trained on?
Well, very little, very little. And that's kind of why I've gotten so involved in this world. And in fact, here at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, we are starting a center for comprehensive sexual medicine to deal not only with specifically women after heart disease, but really after all of these medical conditions. Because whether someone has had cancer or diabetes or multiple sclerosis, and the list is very long, virtually every single medical condition can impact on sexual function. And most doctors are not equipped to deal with that with their patient, which is why we are going to put together a center to do so, because it is important. There is a disparity, and it's a conversation that's not happening that we very much think needs to happen. So we're very excited about that. It's opening in 2017. Of course, I'm seeing patients right now who have these issues. But
what are you talking about in this, right, this symposium that's on Friday? What else are you going to be discussing?
At the symposium on Friday, it's a half-day symposium. It's for the community. There's another symposium the same day for physicians, but this is open to community women. You can sign up in advance and go, of course, which is what we recommend. And it's an entire morning that you will get to hear. I will, of course, be doing a talk on sexual medicine after heart attack, but you will also be hearing from real women who've had heart attacks, cardiologists, other lifestyle people, exercise physiologist. It's really intended not only for women with cardiovascular disease, but for the people in their life. You know, I mentioned that a lot of times the avoidance of sex isn't on the part of the woman, it's on the part of the spouse
mm-hmm.
who's terrified. So we want to get the spouses in there, the partners in there too, because everyone needs to be aware of, quite frankly, how low the risks are and what they can do to minimize the risk. You know, we know that people that go to a rehab program, that exercise regularly, that have sex regularly, are going to have a much, much lower risk. We also know, and I think this is important to point out, sometimes it's not the heart disease, it's the depression that occurs as a result of that. Because we know that people who have depression and who are on antidepressants also can have very severe challenges when it comes to sexual function. So I'm going to be talking about
things,
that as well.
Right.
I'm going to be talking about all of the things that can impact on this and just really get this conversation going.
That's Dr. Lauren Stryker. We'll tweet out information about the event if you followed 21st Show. That's all the information about her event on Friday. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This week, the University of Illinois announced a process for what the school is calling its first ever athletic mascot. It's been 9 years since the University of Illinois retired its controversial Chief Illini Wick, and fans from Roxford to Carbondale are waiting to hear what happens next. This has been a student-led process. The decision was announced by Interim Chancellor Barbara Wilson at a Campus Academic Senate meeting on Monday. Joining us in studio is co-chair of the committee that led that process. He's a student senator. He's a junior, Alex Villanueva. Thanks for being with us, Alex.
Oh, thank you, Nyla, so much.
And on the line with us, sports journalist John Bacon. We'll forgive the fact that he's calling us from Ann Arbor and focus on his expertise in covering the Big Ten and college football. Hey, John, it's great to talk to you.
Hello, good to talk to you as well.
Okay.
And pardon me in advance.
Yes, exactly. Alex, can you talk us through the process? What exactly led you all to say we want to have a committee to create a new mascot on campus?
Well, this process started for me going all the way back to when I first got into the University of Illinois back in 2012. I grew up in Florida, and I applied to Illinois for its academic strengths and merits, and I didn't start looking into athletics until after I got in. And, you know, I was surprised to go and see, you know, what is an Illini? I grew up in Florida. I didn't even know how to pronounce Illini. I called it Illini. You know, my father, who went to Southern Illinois Carbondale, kind of corrected me on it. And I Googled it, and lo and behold, I found out, okay, so they had an Indian mascot, Chief Illini Wick. He looks awesome. You know, what happened to him? You know, and then I started learning about the process, and I came to the University of Illinois. Began going to football games, began hearing, you know, a lot of discontent that the chief was retired. A lot of people were upset about that. But over the past, you know, now 3 years, I began to see a lot of students just wanted something. You know, they understood that the chief was retired. The chief wouldn't be coming back anytime soon, at least in the iteration which he left us. And people wanted to look for a mascot. So at the beginning of the past school year, I spoke to some fellow senators, Mark Scheer, who became the co-chair with me on the committee. I approached him. I asked Mark, do you love Illini Athletics? He says, absolutely. Of course I love Illinois Athletics. I'm like, do you love Chief Illini Weck? And he's like, well, yeah, I do love Chief Illini Weck. Why? It's like, well, do you know the Chief's never going to come back? And, reluctantly, he kind of, said, yeah, he's not going to come back. He's like, well, why don't we do something about that? Why don't we try to make our mark and do something for the student body that I've been seeing that students wanted a mascot? So we began the process, passed a resolution to the student government to create this committee. We formed the committee in February, picking some, a really diverse and, group of students that ranged from...
How many students were there on the committee?
On the committee, there was approximately... See, now you're going to make me do some math
about,
here. I think about 12
I was
going to
say,
so.
I thought it was about 12.
About 12 of us. Mark and I did not vote, and then we had... executive, our student body treasurer, was sat as a non-voting member, and it ranged from MAs. We had an MA on the. We had MAs, RAs. We had a former chief portrayer, Ivan Dozier, who sat on that committee with us, and we met a lot of people. We heard a lot of testimony from students, from faculty and staff, from alumni, community members, from fans. Business leaders, local business leaders, university administration.
What did they say? I imagine you heard a lot of differing opinions.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is what I've been telling people. It's a heartful issue. People take the chief and subsequently the idea of a mascot to heart. And a lot of passions on both sides, a lot of tears were shed throughout the process. People who, by not having a mascot, we continue to have this void where Chief Illini Weck, kind of as the former mascot symbol, as the university and as the committee decided to call it, kind of perpetuating itself in a way which, wasn't conducive to who we are at the University of Illinois. Yet there was a lot of people who felt that the chief, really was this honorific symbol that meant a lot to hundreds of thousands of not only alum, but people from across the state of Illinois and across the country and across the world. And, he was torn from them in 2007, in an unjust way. He had
That's
his last day.
That's what people said to you.
Exactly.
Okay. That's Alex Villanueva. He's also the student body vice president, by the way, at the University of Illinois. He's a junior. We, as Alex said, this is an issue that we know people are really passionate about. So my question to those of you listening throughout Illinois is, what should the mascot be? If you have a suggestion, you can give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet us at 21st Show. Again, that number is 1-800-222-9455. John Bacon, I deliberately thought of you for this conversation because, as Alex was saying, there are Illini fans all over the country. And I was going to say, I dare say even in Ann Arbor. But as a
there
sports
are.
Writer, and this is an issue you've covered across the country with college football, what did you think of when you heard this news on Monday?
Not too surprising and really almost inevitable. I think that whether people like it or not, the march towards Native American free mascots is inexorable. It's inevitable. And, for example, the Washington Redskins fighting this fight, they're going to lose it sooner or later. The only question is when. Now, Redskins is, to me, there are shades of gray, perhaps, to this. As Charles Krauthammer, who is no knee-jerk liberal, as we know, a staunch conservative, as he said about the Redskins, you cannot possibly name your team, give your team a name that you would not say to somebody's face, which you obviously would not in the case of the Redskins. It gets a bit trickier, I think, when you have an actual tribe that was from the area, and depending on the tribe's feeling about that mascot and the use thereof. In the case of Eastern Michigan, for example, they were first the Normalites because they are a teacher college, of course, Michigan Normal School, then switched in the 20s to the Hurons, which is a native tribe to the area. Lake Huron, Huron River, which runs through Ann Arbor, of course, Huron High School I went to here in Ann Arbor. And the Huron tribe members I could find in Oklahoma, Quebec, and elsewhere all urged them to keep the mascot, which was they didn't have a rain dance, they didn't have the headgear and so on that Illinois has or had. And the tribe was vociferous in saying, please do not change the symbol of the Huron. And, of course, they promptly did anyway. So it's a funny business.
Right. And then I'm thinking, Alex, you said you're from Florida. I also grew up in Florida and grew up with Florida State University and going to FSU games. And I would like FSU always points out they always very careful of saying they don't have a mascot, but they have the honor of using the name Seminole. But what I was going to say about FSU is their student government yesterday passed a resolution banning wearing Native American headdresses at sporting events, which isn't even what Seminoles, the Seminole tribe wear, is completely different, as the student government body pointed out also. How many of these efforts, I wanted to ask you, John, as we're talking about here at U of I, Alex and Mark and the other students who led this, how many of these efforts are led by student governments as opposed to the NCAA?
It's a mixed bag, and occasionally also the administration will take the lead. In the case of Eastern Michigan, it was the president who did so. It is the NCAA who did so against the North Dakota Fighting Sioux, which a mildly crazy man named Mr. Engelstad, who made his money in Las Vegas casinos, and would celebrate Hitler's birthday. How about that for a nice little fun fact about anybody you might come across? He, of course, was adamant when he gave the money for the rink, which is glorious, the best rink in college hockey, that they not change the name. And finally, and the Sioux were very much against that name. It perpetuated the stereotype they did not want, and they did not have a good relationship with the school. And so they've now changed it to Sioux as a minor compromise, I guess. But these things come from all ends, and they are handled very differently. And as you pointed out about Florida State, Florida State was very smart in establishing a very strong relationship with the tribe in question, the Osceola.
Well, they also, there's even a revenue-sharing agreement, right? I think the Seminole tribe actually gets...
Scholarships have been set up for tribe members. So they've got a very good relationship. The first thing any school that wants to keep it should do is talk to the tribe and see what they think and what they want and work with them to make it a partnership. Those who don't, like the Sioux, usually end up on the wrong end of the stick.
Mm-hmm.
And not the wrong end, but we'll have to change it. But Illinois' case is kind of a shade of gray of all these because there's some historical background, but it's also been twisted. And as a history major, of course, I take that stuff very seriously. So your first problem with most of these things is they're not accurate. And so therefore, they're, you know, white man caricatures of what's happening. Illinois is half accurate, half not, of course, as you guys know. The rain dance clearly was a problem for a lot of people. The headdress clearly is. And yet, as Alex pointed out, the feelings for this are extremely strong. And one thing you come across very quickly in any discussion of college athletics is it's not a business to people who love it. It is a quasi-secular religion, if you will, and that is what the Illinois people are running into now.
We're speaking with John Bacon on the line with us from Ann Arbor. His upcoming book is actually called End Zone, The Rise, Fall, and Return of Michigan Football. Longtime Big Ten sports writer covering college football. In studio with me, Alex Villanueva is a student senator at the University of Illinois. He is a co-chair of the committee that has started the process that was announced on Monday to create a mascot for U of I. And to that point, John and Alex, what both of you have made about the culture and changing the culture and feelings about this. This morning, we actually went out on the quad at the University of Illinois to ask students and staff what they think about a new mascot.
I'd like to see Chief Eleni Wick brought back, in addition with maybe an expanded part of our Native American studies dedicated to the studies of the Illini.
I think it's rude to take someone else's culture and put it on display and use it in that sense when, like, a lot of other tribes have kind of, like, dissented against it and said they don't like it.
I personally like the chief. I am an alumni as well as an employee here now and a graduate student, so a little bit nostalgic for the chief.
What kind of mascot do you think we should get?
Maybe a farmer. I don't know, like the Nebraskan Husker, like something similar.
I like the idea that they are looking into a new a mascot to bring some unity to the campus. So I think that could be a fun idea.
Thanks to producer Christine Herman for that, for going out on the quad. So, I mean, it's clear that even when looking forward, the legacy of what is in the past is kind of hanging over this process. Alex, you're in here. I was wondering, what do you say to other students? What are you saying now to alumni and other people as you all are starting this process? How do you frame this moving forward?
Well, one thing that I frame moving forward is that from 1926 to 2007, the alum have their symbol. They have Chief Eleni Wick, right? And he's never going to go away. The history of the chief will never leave. The university continues to hold the branding, will continue to sell that branding. You're still able to get, you know, off-the-market branding. That's something that's a part of their history. And that's one thing that the committee kind of recommended, is that we're not here to remove the chief, right? There's a constant rhetoric that goes around, you know, not only on campus but across Illinois, is that the chief was banned. The chief wasn't banned. You're right. You have every right to have the chief there. You know, like I said, the chief continues to come to certain games, continues to march.
Is it something you want to see? As someone who's now leading the search for a mascot, do you want the chief to still be there at games?
Well, I don't know about a game specifically. You know, it's absolutely in their First Amendment right to do that, right? The university can't say, no, you can't do that. But I think that's important to move forward, is to make sure that the alums still have something that they care about. You know, the goal moving forward is that this mascot is for the students from, you know, I hope 2017, you know, through, you know, the end of time, the end of when, you know, when people stop watching college athletics. That's the goal for them. And that's the way myself and a lot of the students look at it. It's for the student body, and this is something the student body wants. And it's important that the chief, you know, remains in his place in history, for the alum to continue to have that attachment to, because there's this constant rhetoric that we're here to take away the chief. And like, no, we're not. We're here to move forward. That way, you know, students from the class of 2018, you know, to the class of 3073 are able to have something that they can hold to and cherish. There's this constant, you can't replace tradition. Well, you can replace tradition. You know, the chief came about in 1926 after, you know, this is something that, you know, chief people never like to talk about. Starting as early as 1912, Illinois athletics were called the Illinois Indians. So there's actually, you know, a history that extends prior to 1926, and the chief is part of that evolving history. And, you know, traditions are born every single day. And, you know, by saying that you can't change tradition, you know, that's just wrong. And the students want to change and create their own tradition to carry on for generations to come.
We're asking you what you think the new mascot should be. Let's go to Don from Champaign. Hey, Don, welcome to the 21st. Do you have an idea for who the new mascot should be?
Yes.
What is
it? The binary codes and have 30 of them and let them do all kinds of calisthenics and acrobatics that happen.
That's a good nod to
the big part in computers.
All right, to the computer history. Thanks for that, Don. John Bacon, where does the University of Illinois go from here? I mean, we have examples of, say, Bradley University. I know they dropped all of their Native American imagery, and now they have, they tried the Bobcats. Now they've gone with, I think it's called Kaboom. How does a major university with a major sports program go forward with this?
It's no matter what you're going to do, you're just not going to keep everyone happy. And this issue, as Alex has already discovered, is absolutely impossible. If you've got 55 or 60%, call that good. So there's no easy way out here. I think that for me it boils down to a few, the Bacon rule, if you will, the three codes I stick by, is A, is it historically accurate? There are no tribes named Braves, Redskins, Chiefs, etc., which are insulting in their own ways. B, what does the tribe think? Of course, that's, I think, one of the biggest issues as well. Not just in general, you know, yes or no, but how it's used, how they feel about it. And those two things right there really will drive the issue. Then, of course, the alumni, the fans, and all the rest, which to me rank third in this case. But I would definitely talk to those they can. And again, it's also, I mean, I think a rain dance is pretty easy to stop these days. Again, the term Redskins, I cannot see going forward very much longer for a lot of reasons. But it's also a tricky thing about what parts of our past we keep, which parts we don't. It's a matter of fact that all 10 original Big Ten states were all Indian names. Minnesota, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, you name it. I, of course, again, live right on the Heron River, and we're not going to change that. So there's a fine line between what we scrub out and what we choose to keep. I think in this case I would do what Alex is doing. And by the way, for a college student, he sounds like a mature young man. And that is talk to the tribe, talk to those you can, and then talk to the faculty senate, the students, the alums, and all the rest. But I think change is clearly going to come, and people are going to have to accept that. And what you don't want to be is you look back 50 years from now and think, holy mackerel, we kept that name long after anyone else did.
Yeah, well, and it looks like, right, thanks for that, John, because it looks like the U of I is really moving forward on this. Alex, really quick, we have less than a minute left. What happens next? You guys now have there's now a committee, there's a whole process that's starting, another committee.
So what's going to happen now is most likely the chancellor will kind of create a framework for what will happen. She'll then approach people that, you know, feel like they would be appropriate for the committee, right? These are people who have a big share in life on campus and across the state, maybe even across the nation, you know, influential alumni, you know, influential members of the faculty and student leaders, to make sure that it's a wholesome kind of process, make sure everyone's included.
Are you going to be a part of it?
I will not. I will not sit on the committee.
Okay.
I will not sit on the committee.
Well, this is one of the people who started it. So thanks so much, Alex Villanueva, student senator. He's student body vice president and co-chair of the committee that brought this all about. Thanks also, John Bacon, and everyone who called as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nyla.
The 21st is made possible by Custer & Bradley, LLP, providing legal service to the Urbana-Champaign community since 1895. Custer & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at CusterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Exelon is warning again that three of the power company's nuclear plants in Illinois aren't making enough money to stay open. Cheap natural gas prices are part of the reason. The company says that some or all of those plants could close if the state of Illinois does not provide some financial help. And it says the Clinton plant in central Illinois would be the first to shut down. So what's the future of nuclear power in the state? With us now is Steve Daniels, a senior reporter for Crane Chicago Business. Steve, welcome to the 21st.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Illinois gets about half of its energy from nuclear power, which is more than any other state by a long shot, if folks didn't know that. Could you give us some background on nuclear power, Illinois, Steve? Why are we so different than other states?
Well, that traces back to a campaign that Commonwealth Edison back in the 70s and 80s, late 60s, 70s, and 80s took on to build these giant nuclear plants to basically handle the Northern Illinois region's electricity needs for the foreseeable future. And there was a very checkered history with how those plants operated, how expensive they were. All of that is fairly ancient history at this point. But ultimately, finally, took a couple of decades, they got the plants to run well, and they actually do perform a very important function in terms of providing electricity here.
So now the company that operates every one of those silos in Illinois, Exelon, says three of its facilities are causing them to lose money. Where are those reactors, Steve?
Well, the three that I think it's probably actually two, but the three that, you're talking about are the Clinton plant, which is in central Illinois, the Quad Cities plant on the Mississippi River, and the Byron plant near Rockford. I think the Byron plant is not in any imminent danger. But clearly, Quad City, Clinton is in very imminent danger, and Quad City's in relatively imminent danger.
Why are they losing money?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. One, probably the main one is very, very low natural gas prices that have persisted now for several years, largely due to the sort of the fracking revolution that has transformed that industry. And natural gas prices are very closely correlated with the wholesale power prices that Exelon's power plants earn on the competitive market. Those are not regulated plants. They're not guaranteed a return. They are subject to the whims of the market. And right now, the market is very, very difficult for those plants to recover their costs.
Well, when you talk about the market, I wanted to ask about some of your reporting, because you've looked into Exelon's claims that these facilities are losing money. Exelon's saying that it needs relief from the state of Illinois to continue to operate that. But what did you investigate and what did you find?
Well, this has been going on now for a couple of years, where Exelon has raised alarm bells in Springfield about the economic state of their nuclear plants, and there has been an awful lot of confusion about whether all of the plants or some of the plants or none of the plants make money at various times, a lot of it has been, I don't know if it's been deliberate, a lot of it has been, not helpful, I would say, in terms of clarifying what exactly the situation is. So most recently, in lobbying materials that Exelon circulated in Springfield, they very clearly stated that all six of their nuclear stations in Illinois would lose money in 2016. That is clearly not the case. There was a fairly tortured explanation when I talked to them about what exactly they were trying to say there, and ultimately it boiled back down to, hey, we've got two real hardship cases in Clinton. Mm.
And is this a different story that's told in Springfield than this told on Wall Street?
Yes. On Wall Street, everybody understands that the prices that they're actually, the revenues they're actually fetching on the market here in 2016 were hedged a couple of years ago at much higher levels. So as a fleet, they are likely to make money, not a ton of money, so you know, that's not a great thing, but they are likely to make money in Illinois this year.
We're talking to Steve Daniels, a senior reporter for Crain's Chicago Business. And Steve, you had a story yesterday about Dynegy, the energy company, reducing coal fire units in two places, reducing the amount of energy they put out. Does the reason they're shutting down have anything to do with the reason that nuclear is in trouble as well? Does this all have to do with natural gas prices or no?
Yes, it's very much tied into that. There's other factors as well. Coal plants have environmental restrictions, environmental controls. They have, in some of those, one of those cases, one of those plants that needs really pretty substantial investment in cleaning up and cleanup technology to improve its emissions. And then also they're in a downstate, which is, this gets a little bit in the weeds, but is in a different regional power grid that has a different market structure. So the one that serves northern Illinois is more lucrative to power generators. The one that serves southern Illinois is less so. That also is hurting Dynegy.
Well, and apart from the energy cost of this, and we're going to get to the utility bill side of this in just a minute, but I wanted to ask you about the economic impact on these regions if these plants do eventually get shut down. Like, as Dynegy said, the plan is for, I believe, two of these plants to be shut down within the year.
Yeah, I think it was three units.
Okay, sorry.
Both of them are big plants. Yeah, so 190 direct jobs, plant jobs, would be vulnerable. They referenced, you know, thousands of indirect jobs just because of the functioning of the plants and their economic importance in those regions, in those areas, and then something like $1 billion in economic activity that would be lost as a result of that.
And then what were to happen if we were to lose three nuclear facilities too?
Probably the economic impact of that would be worse because nuclear plants employ considerably more people than coal-fired plants do. They're more complicated to operate. They require more personnel, more specialized personnel. And then also they contribute greatly to the property taxes of the communities that host them. Yeah, and there's a similar indirect economic benefits as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that would be if three plants were lost, that would be a significant blow economically.
That's Steve Daniels with Crain's Chicago Business. Let's bring someone else into this conversation as well. Dave Collada is president of the Citizens Utility Board, CUB. Dave, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Dave, how long has Exelon asked for assistance from the state, and why are they doing this now?
Well, you know, I think that they're doing it, as Steve said, because natural gas prices have declined significantly. I think it is the case that that two of their plants are losing money. I think that they, as a for-profit company under some pressure for Wall Street, are trying to make those plants profitable. I think the approach that they pursued to this point by focusing on the overall fleet, which would have the consequence of giving the company a lot more money, and having plants that are profitable receive extra money, I don't think that's been the right approach. I don't think they've gotten good feedback for that. But as a for-profit entity, they're going to do what they can to try to make money, and I think that that's what they've been doing.
When they ask for relief, what do they mean, Dave? Are we talking about electricity rate hikes or subsidies?
Yeah, to this point, they've pursued what they call a low-carbon portfolio standard. It would be similar to a renewable portfolio standard where, in effect, you're paying a little bit extra. In this case, it would be for the nuclear power. So they're definitely seeking to raise consumer bills. I don't think that approach has been very successful. I think the fact that it's been, as Steve alluded to, their whole fleet in Illinois is profitable. So what we're really talking about are two specific plants. We're talking about the Clinton plant and the Quad Cities plant. So, you know, I think our preference would be that if they're going to try to do something like this, that they really focus on the plants that are at issue.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, even that you have a role for the Illinois Commerce Commission in really determining how much are these plants losing money if they are. And really having a role in determining whether it makes sense at all to be even talking about this, because at the end of the day, this is a consequence of market forces. And those are markets that Exelon helped put into place. Really, it's low natural gas prices that are the cause of most of this. And what we don't want to end up with is a situation where we're sort of socializing risk but privatizing profits.
So just to be clear for our listeners, the Illinois Commerce Commission would be the entity that would approve all of those rate hikes. But Dave, I wanted to ask you, from Exelon's standpoint, they're saying, and you mentioned a little bit of this, that they're really only asking for incentives that are similar to what renewable power sources like wind and solar receive. So would you agree with that?
Well, no, I think that there are differences in what they're proposing. I think the core of the issue at the end of the day is really what's best for consumers. And, I do think that there's an interesting empirical question about what would happen if Clinton and Quad Cities close. But it is an empirical question, and there's a lot of assumptions about the future. And what we have to do is make sure that whatever the state chooses to do, if it does anything, that ultimately consumers are protected and that we're not creating perverse incentives. The market structure that we have in Illinois is one that has been greatly profitable for Exelon, and in fact, all generators, up until basically the fracking boom. And so they really benefited from that, and they made big profits when market prices were high. If you're not careful, and if you create a situation that sets an artificial floor to market prices without providing a ceiling, what you've done is really put a lot of risk on consumers, and that's not the way we want to go. That's not a very good outcome. So, we're certainly willing to consider proposals, but to this point, the type of proposals they put forth, I don't really think have been the right way to go and really a fair deal for consumers.
Steve, do you have a sense that these nuclear power plants will actually be shut down, or is this, what's your read of the situation?
My read of the situation at this point, obviously Exelon has threatened already to close them and then backed off of those threats once before.
So was that a year ago? Or
that was a little over a year ago, okay. and they said they were going to close. I think both their expectations, they would announce closings of Clinton and Quad Cities, and then they backed off of both of those threats. So there's obviously a little bit of a boy who cried wolf situation here in terms of, okay, they keep threatening and they keep not following through. I think that right now they have no choice but to announce a closure of Clinton. It would happen no later than the fall if they get no relief at all, that their investors would really be extremely unhappy if they did not do that at the very least.
And you might
see a similar announcement regarding Quad Cities, although Quad is committed to stay open for another few years.
Dave Collada, from your standpoint, your viewpoint of the Citizens Utility Board, what do you want taxpayers to know about this issue?
It is very complicated. I think the approach that Exelon has pursued so far has been the wrong one. I do think that, especially in a world where if you assume that something like the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan is going to be upheld, which would essentially put a price on carbon, that it does get into some complicated questions about would we be better off trying to find some fair arrangement that keeps Clinton and Quad Cities operational. But those are very, very complicated questions, and you're on very risky terrain for consumers here when you're talking about this. It's our hope that Exelon will pursue a different type of approach. Clearly, anything that happens has to be part of an overall package that includes investment in energy efficiency. It's really the clean energy economy based on new technologies and solar and energy efficiency that's the future. That's where you're going to see real consumer benefits, environmental benefits, and we think a lot more jobs. But we're willing to engage in that discussion. I just think that Exelon needs to pursue a different approach and really be open to negotiations, and so we'll have to wait and see what they decide to do.
That's Dave Collada. He's president of the Citizens Utility Board. I want to thank also Steve Daniels, senior reporter for Crane's Chicago Business. Steve, really quickly, as we're thinking about this future of clean energy, and we're thinking particularly about this with nuclear energy, factoring into this, of course, as a clean energy source, do you think we're going to keep kind of seeing these things in the future, especially when you add the fracking into the mix?
When you say seeing these things, what do you mean?
Asking for more subsidies or power companies asking for more subsidies for
absolutely
nuclear.
until either they are provided or they make the decisions to close these plants. We're seeing the same debates in other states as well.
That's Steve Daniels, a senior reporter for Crane Chicago Business. Thanks also to Dave Colotta, president of the Citizens Utility Board. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Finally, we'd like to wish all you Star Wars fans out there a wonderful May the 4th. If you happen to be in the Tuscola area this weekend, there'll be a free Star Wars-themed art exhibit taking place. It's an intergalactic party that will feature new artwork inspired by the franchise. Costumes are welcome, but not required. That event will take place from 6 to 10 on Saturday at the Vault Arts Collective. On this May 4th, it looks even less likely there'll be a Lucas Museum for downtown Chicago. In the ongoing tussle between Friends of the Park versus Mayor Emanuel and the Lucas family, which includes Chicago native Melody Hobson, yesterday Hobson issued a sharply worded statement saying they would be looking elsewhere to house the museum. She called Friends of the Park, which had sued the city over one of the proposed lakefront sites, a small special interest group that, quote, co-opted and hijacked the process. Well, we'll see what happens. Until then. That does it for the 21st today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.